Hey everyone, it's me, W. Kamau Bell. Welcome back to the ACLU's podcast, At Liberty. We've made it to the holiday break. Almost. We're recording this on Thursday, December 4th. As we look ahead to 2026, a busy Supreme Court term is already underway, with trans rights, redistricting, birthright citizenship, and more on the docket. And the ACLU is representing clients in many of this year's banner cases. So today, for our final episode of the year, we're turning our focus to, dun-dun-dun, the judicial branch. We have a very special guest joining us in studio. I'm so happy we're doing it in studio. She needs no introduction, but I'm going to give her one anyway. Cecilia Wong is the National Legal Director of the American Civil Liberties Union. She's a voice of reason and authority in an increasingly uncertain time. And we're so glad to have her back on the show. We've spoken three times since the presidential election. Today's number four. And at various points, the country has been in different states of reckoning with what's going on in the country. And your advice has consistently been, stay ready, that the ACLU stays ready. Where are you at right now with that idea of staying ready?
So it's not just a matter of staying ready for what comes in the future, but, you know, for the last 10 months, 11 months, we've actually been carrying out our plans. We've actually been responding to the federal government taking away people's rights in the most drastic and extreme ways possible. So it's a matter of actually acting to protect people from the government when it's trying to make incursions into their most basic rights and liberties. So, you know, since January 20th, our case count now just against the Trump administration is 118 lawsuits and 97 other legal actions, including things like amicus briefs that we file in support of others who are challenging the Trump administration, Freedom of Information Act requests, and administrative complaints that are, you know, might be a prelude to further lawsuits. So we're still, throughout this whole time, we've got a success rate of about 80% where we have asked courts to step in and protect people from what the federal government is doing. So I'm quite proud of the work that we've been doing at the ACLU in going into courts in as a matter of, you know, rapid response. In order to protect people's rights and liberties.
So, like, I think to the average person, things seem hectic and fast-moving and dynamic, I'll use the basis of, for what's going on in politics in this country right now and how it's affecting either your life or the people, or the lives of people around you. Does it feel that way inside the ACLU? Does it feel like, and not to say hectic, I know you're all very sound and rational people, but, like, this is a lot.
It is a lot. And we've, you know, built up this track record and feel an obligation, a professional obligation and a moral obligation to step in to protect our communities. So we've been able to do that because people are working around the clock and doing the work of three people. But we've also been able to do it thanks to the support of all of our ACLU members. People are supporting us financially. People are supporting us through giving their time to volunteer, to do calls to members of Congress, or to hit the streets with the No Kings March. So it has been a lot, as you said. This federal government is really, I think, unprecedented. Certainly in my lifetime, in the ways that it is not only going after politically vulnerable minority communities, which everyone expected, but also in making these broad-scale attacks on the foundations of U.S. democracy. I think when we last spoke on this podcast, you know, he had already started going after private law firms. Started, you know, criticizing federal judges who ruled against him. But since then, we have seen kind of the worst things that we were planning for and anticipating, sending the National Guard into Chicago, Portland, Los Angeles, and Washington, D.C., really going against one of the founding principles of our country. Our founders, for all their flaws and all the structural problems with the original Constitution prior to Reconstruction, one thing that they really saw clearly was that you don't want the executive to be able to use the military against the people. Mm. And Donald Trump has blown through that founding norm, that founding principle of our country. We've also seen the government become really unleashed in large part due to a Supreme Court order in an ACLU case called Vasquez Perdomo, which put on pause the lower court orders that we had won, preventing the federal government, ICE agents, immigration agents, from racially profiling people in Los Angeles. Using a four-part profile that included being Latino or appearing to be Latino mm-hmm. as a factor. And so you see the unraveling, right? Now you see the Trump administration now, I think, encouragingly coming under fire from bipartisan members of Congress for, killing people in the Caribbean and the Pacific. You know, all these areas where the president once again, as he did in his first term, but even more in a second term, putting on the mantle of national emergency mm-hmm. or national security as an excuse, a flimsy excuse for him to engage in the most lawless behavior, literally killing people, mm-hmm. literally mm-hmm. locking mm-hmm. Americans up mm-hmm. In the name of our national security. So it is a lot, but we're out there. We're out there.
You said a lot, and then get back to it is a lot.
It is a lot.
Yeah. I just want to say that is really helpful for people who are maybe listening to the podcast, or people like myself, because I think sometimes we can be gaslit into thinking that we just perceive it as a lot as individuals, but actually this is just business as usual. I think mm-hmm. being gaslit by the Trump administration or even other politicians to sort of say like, no, everything, this is just what happens. But to hear someone who's in the trenches like you say, yeah, this is a lot, it's actually very helpful.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the thing is, it's a lot, but we are a lot as well in response.
Yes.
Right? We saw the largest single day of protest by the American people back in October at the No Kings rally, which the ACLU helped to put together. And we've got, so many tens of thousands of people, mm-hmm. hundreds of thousands of people as members, tens of thousands of people who are joining in to take action against what these incursions into our individual rights and freedoms.
Thank you for bringing up No Kings, because there are many people who want to go, what did that solve? So the big crowd showed up on that one day for a few hours that had a start time and an end time. What did that solve? Can you give those people, as a lawyer, a proper defense for why the No Kings rallies? Because there will be another one, I'm sure, at some point.
Right. So the No Kings rally, I mean, those critics have a point. But I would say in response that no one action, no one lawsuit, no one protest, no one meeting with a member of Congress is alone going to stop the Trump administration from violating people's rights. It's the combined impact of all of this work that we're doing, every one of the millions of people who showed up and who need to show up again, not just to protest, but to be in community with others taking action. I think one of the silver linings of how unleashed the Trump administration has become 10 months in is that more and more people find something to oppose in what this president is doing. As he blows past all of the constraints, structural constraints, legal constraints, moral constraints on presidential behavior, more and more people are saying, hey, this affects me. You know, your person who lives in a Chicago suburb who suddenly has armed federal, troops coming into their neighborhoods and trying to just disappear people off the streets, that person might not have, had immigration as their top issue that they care about. when they go to the polling place or, you know, when they take action. But now it's become real for more and more people. So I think the silver lining is that as we see millions of people taking to the streets, those millions of people are also taking other actions in order to defend our democracy and our free country.
Well, thank you for that, because I think that's the important thing, is that this is it's a potpourri of actions. It's not just,
that's right.
Yeah, I showed up that one day, mission accomplished.
And yeah,
I appreciate you even giving credit to the people who criticize. Fine, criticize it, but here's what it is, you know.
Right, and yeah. If you're going to criticize it, then do something.
That's the other part. That's the other, like, that's how I tend to respond in my mentions. If I sort of feel the need to, it's like, okay, what's your plan? Mm-hmm. You know, fine, great. That's not good. What's your plan? And that's generally when they.
The other thing I think about No Kings is there were 2,300 separate events associated with the No Kings protests that day.
Yeah.
Right. And so people may be thinking about the hundreds of thousands of people who take to the streets in New York or DC or in large cities, but the power of, you know, 500 people marching on Main Street mm-hmm. in a small town. That is powerful because it's not only aimed at Donald Trump or people who work for him.
Yeah.
It's aimed at the mayor of that town. It's aimed at the sheriff of that town to say, this is what we the people believe in, and we don't want you to participate in this machinery of oppression that is the president is trying to roll out. The president needs the power of local and state officials in order to roll out his plans. And as more and more states and municipalities are joining in opposing the president's actions in order to protect their people's freedom, I think that's really significant.
Mm-hmm. So we're going to talk about the Supreme Court and some Supreme Court cases. Are we still calling them the Supreme Court, or are they just the court now? It's a cheap joke, but
are indeed the honorable the Supreme Court of the United States.
I understand. So before we talk about upcoming cases, can we do like a look back on some of the cases that have happened recently? Like, remember when you were a kid and they say previously on?
Yes.
Yeah.
The recap of the last season.
Yeah. The last season
of SCOTUS, of the ACLU at the Supreme Court of the United States. So last term, we had three merits cases that were on the Supreme Court's, you know, main oral argument calendar. And those cases were Free Speech Coalition versus Paxton, Scrimeti, and Calais. So we had an interesting lineup last term. We ended up with two losses in Scrimeti and Free Speech Coalition. Free Speech Coalition was a case where we joined in a challenge at the Supreme Court level to a Texas state law that, in the name of protecting children, really targeted adult content, including non-pornographic content, on websites in a grossly overbroad way. And because we believed that the Texas law was infringing on many people's First Amendment rights, and could be used in a targeted way by Texas state officials against content they dislike, for example, LGBT content or sexual health content, women's rights content, as well as their avowed target of pornography, we joined with the lawyers for the Free Speech Coalition in the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court said that this law, even though it targets based on viewpoint or content, was subject only to what's called rational basis scrutiny. Which is not the usual standard that applies when First Amendment rights are at stake. And so there's an interesting and a really unfortunate parallel with the second case that I mentioned from last term, which is called Scrimeti. This was a case where we challenged a Tennessee state law that took away transgender teens' rights, anyone under the age of 19, all of their rights to access gender-affirming healthcare in the state of Tennessee. And again, this was a case where the state was claiming that they needed to protect children from decisions that those children's parents made with their medical providers, with their physicians, that this was medically necessary health care. And Tennessee was one of 26 states that had suddenly passed these laws taking away essential health care from transgender youth. So that was a case where we, you know, the Supreme Court could have taken even worse and more drastic action. But the Supreme Court did not actually change the worst case scenario that could have come to pass in the Scrimeti case was that the Supreme Court would say transgender people do not have the same rights, the same protections against sex discrimination as other people, as other Americans. The Supreme Court fortunately did not do that. The worst case scenario did not happen.
Yay.
But, you know, and that's a doctrinal victory. That's a legal victory. Yeah. The impact on transgender youth in these states that have bans on essential health care is really dire. Particularly for people who can't afford to travel out of state for this health care. And the third case was the Calais case. This was Louisiana's congressional redistricting. And the procedural posture of the case is a little bit unusual. We were coming in basically to defend a remedial map that the state of Louisiana had enacted in response to our litigation victory in another case called Robinson. So to give the background, after the 2020 census in 2022, the Louisiana legislature, redraws the congressional districts. And we went in and sued under the Voting Rights Act and argued that the new map illegally diluted the voting power of Black Louisianans. And we won a preliminary injunction in that case, including an affirmance of the preliminary injunction in the very conservative U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit. So after, their preliminary stages of the case, we win twice in the district court and in the Fifth Circuit. The Louisiana legislature basically says, OK, we see the writing on the wall. We are going to draw a new map. And that map drew a second district in which Black voters had a shot, an opportunity to elect their representatives of choice. That was the map that was used in the 2024 election. And we saw two Black representatives in the Louisiana delegation to Congress for the first time in a long, long time.
Yeah.
Right. And so at that point, the Calais case starts. So a group of self-described non-African-American voters in Louisiana sue in a different district in Louisiana. And they claim now under the 14th Amendment of the Constitution, the Equal Protection Clause, that the fact that the Louisiana legislature drew a second Black Opportunity District was a racial gerrymander. That is basically, it's a reverse discrimination claim.
The reverse racism.
Right, exactly.
Yes.
So that case is argued in the Supreme Court last term, and we were expecting a decision on it at the end of the term. Now, just a couple terms before this, we and LDF had another congressional redistricting case at the Supreme Court out of Alabama, and the case was called Milligan. And we won that case in the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court said, look, state legislatures, you know, in drawing congressional maps or legislative maps are, you know, it's just sausage making. There are a lot of political considerations. They are trying to protect incumbents. They're doing all kinds of partisan maneuvering. And we're going to give states breathing room. We're going to give legislatures breathing room to draw maps.
Yeah.
So in Calais now, last term, we said, look, the Louisiana legislature gets breathing room. They had multiple goals here. They wanted to protect a bunch of incumbents, including Speaker of the House, Mike Johnson.
Yeah.
They wanted to and they wanted to comply with the court order that we won in the Robinson case. So at the end of the term, we're all expecting this ruling, and the Supreme Court doesn't decide the case. Instead, they kicked the case to this term and set it for re-argument. And they add another question that they want the parties to address. And the question, an ominous one, is, did Louisiana's drawing of a second Black majority district violate the Equal Protection Clause? Right.
Yeah.
And so that was one of the first cases argued this term in October. And we are now waiting to see what happens in that Louisiana redistricting case.
I mean, that case sounds like it has so much of the challenge of righting the wrongs that have been done in this country in the name of this country by the people in charge of this country. Like, you take it all the way over here, which we all go, it seems like it's wrong that it's all the way over here. We try to do things to correct that. And suddenly now you're saying it's unfair to the fact that, like, it's right. It just, yeah, it's like, so we can't correct the wrongs, you know?
Yeah. And it's not just about correcting past wrongs, though it is very much about that. It's also trying to deal with one of the structural problems with American democracy, right? The people should be choosing their representatives.
Yes.
And this kind of redistricting that, you know, it does either dilutes minority voters, partisan gerrymandering, all of that gets it backwards. Instead of the people choosing the representatives, the representatives are choosing
who they want to vote for them.
Exactly. Yeah. They draw the districts in a way that is diluting people's voting strength, that is making my vote less, way less than other people's.
Yeah.
And so it's a serious issue. And, you know, I think, you know, this was the cliffhanger, right, from last season.
Yeah.
And we'll see what the Supreme Court does. If they, I just think it'll be a real challenge for them to, and by the way, Louisiana switched sides. Right. Which I think the question, the supplemental question was aimed at getting the state to change sides because they were defending the map last time around, right?
They were defending the new map.
They were defending their new map that they drew.
Yeah.
And then this term, after the Supreme Court asked this supplemental question, the state says, yeah, you should hold that this is unconstitutional.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's a real test for not only our democracy, but for the legitimacy of the Supreme Court. Did they mean it a couple terms ago when they said in the Milligan case, in the Alabama case, that state legislatures have breathing room?
I mean, you just snuck in the middle of that. This is a real test for the legitimacy of the Supreme Court. Like this, like, just that little Easter egg in there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think, you know, many of the cases this term, we now, this is shaping up, by the way, we're on pace to have our busiest year at the Supreme Court ever.
Yeah.
We have three other cases already in the Supreme Court, and there are a few others in the pipeline that might make it for this term. And, you know, two of the other cases we have are, again, key cases about transgender Americans' rights to be free from discrimination like everybody else. These are the BPJ and Hecox cases where we are defending the rights of trans girls and women to participate in sports in schools, K-12 and higher education. And so, you know, this is these are cases where, you know, the Supreme Court really, if they applied their ordinary rules, shouldn't have taken these cases last term. They should have sent them back and said, hey, take another look at this, lower courts, in light of what we said in the Scrimeti case on healthcare. But instead, they took them. And now our opponents, the states of West Virginia and Idaho, kind of fomented by these anti-LGBT activists, are trying to introduce all kinds of so-called evidence going to athletic advantage that were not decided in the that were not presented in the lower courts. So it's like really procedurally improper from the get-go.
Yeah.
And we'll see what the Supreme Court does. We've actually asked the court not to credit these disputed facts that our opponents are relying on, and asking them to send the cases back and let the lower courts weigh the evidence, which is the role of the lower courts, and go from there.
Since we did previously on, and now you're sort of leading into the upcoming season, what other cases are coming up for the ACLU?
So we have the fourth case where we're already on. I'm breaking news here, probably for a lot of folks.
Oh, good. We don't do that that often on this podcast.
So we have a Second Amendment case in the court this term.
Oh.
So we've just joined the attorneys for in a criminal case called U.S. versus Hemani. And this is a case challenging, in the context of a criminal prosecution, a federal statute that makes it a felony to possess a firearm if you are, and I quote, an unlawful user of a controlled substance or you're addicted to a controlled substance. And our client, Mr. Hemani, was charged in a Texas federal court with possessing a gun. And he admitted when he was questioned by federal agents that he uses marijuana. So the question really is, can the government make it a federal crime to own a gun, which is a right everybody else has, when you use marijuana, or even if you are addicted to a controlled substance, which of course encompasses people who don't use drugs.
Yeah. But if you're in recovery, but you're known to be an addict, you have publicly announced yourself as an addict to that substance.
And whether the law is applied in that way will depend on the whims of a federal prosecutor. Right. And so we've joined the attorneys, the legal team for Mr. Hemani. Interestingly, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit, remember I said they're conservative court, on Second Amendment issues, they are very liberal in the sense that they are in favor of individual rights.
Everything goes.
And they struck down this federal law, 18 U.S.C. 922 G3, in Mr. Hemani's case.
Did you see that off the top of your head, 18 U.S., you just rattled it off?
I know the numbers.
Okay. I was like, you didn't even look down. You're 18 U.S.G. I'm like, okay. All right.
So, I think the case is really fundamentally about whether the federal government can take away a core constitutional right based on its categorical and irrebuttable presumption that you're dangerous because you use marijuana or you're addicted to marijuana.
It just seems weird to me when at the same time many Second Amendment advocates don't even want to hold against people who want guns, like their past criminal records or their past mental health issues. Like you don't want to hold those against people, but you want to hold I smoke weed against people.
Right. Well, I think the Second Amendment advocacy community is on the right side of this issue.
No, that's what I'm saying. But there seems to be like, it's funny on this. It's just
you raise a good point, Kamau, because this statute, I'll rattle off the numbers again, okay?
Yeah, please.
18 U.S.C. 922G, which is the federal law that makes it a crime to own a firearm if you are in certain categories, right?
Yeah.
And this is one of them, unlawful user or addicted to a controlled substance. There are other subsections that make it a crime to own a firearm if you are, and I quote again, a prohibited alien, or, and I quote again, a mental defective. And the big one that is one of the most commonly prosecuted federal crimes is if you have a felony conviction, any felony conviction, state or federal.
Yeah.
And so if I have a felony conviction for, I don't know, pirating music online, and I never served any time in jail or prison, I got probation, I now can't own a firearm because of that felony conviction. And to your point, this statute is vastly disproportionately used against people of color.
It's
a trap, right?
Yeah.
It's a, no pun intended, really. It's a loaded weapon in the federal criminal code for prosecutors to use.
It's a way to throw something else, another crime on the fire.
That's right. It's a major driver of federal incarceration.
It's like the laws in LA, like, you know, it's like loitering and vagrancy. Like, oh, well, we'll get you for something, you know.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. Whew. What else we got?
What else we got? Okay. The rest. So those are the four cases we know are going to be argued in the Supreme Court. We've obviously filed a lot of amicus briefs, but we have at least three other cases that are in the pipeline that might end up being ACLU cases at the Supreme Court this term. There are two more redistricting cases, cases we won below, where the states are the ones filing an appeal in the Supreme Court. One is Mississippi's state legislative redistricting map, where we won our case challenging the pre-existing map after the 2020 census.
Yes.
And got five more Black opportunity districts.
Yes.
In the Mississippi state legislature. And remember, I talked about the Alabama congressional redistricting yes. case. That one's back because the state of Alabama, after we won in the Supreme Court,
did so many nice things. They were so excited. They decided to be nice to everybody, and especially to Black people. Is that what they did?
They were so
My
excited.
My dad's home state. Is that what they did?
They were so excited that they drew another map uh-huh. that illegally diluted Black voting power.
Yeah, that's about right.
And this time yeah. it was so blatant that the district court found that they engaged in intentional race discrimination, which that wasn't the case the first time around. So Alabama has now filed a direct appeal in our case. And the third one is a very major case. It's Trump's effort to ban birthright citizenship.
Ooh.
So as you know, we won two cases.
Yes.
Challenging Trump's birthright citizenship executive order. We filed our first case within 2 hours of his issuance of the executive order.
Why it take so long? Come on. We gotta move quickly. We're a hard boss. I'm
so,
hard, yeah.
you know, we filed a lawsuit on behalf of individual expecting parents. A couple dozen states filed challenges to birthright citizenship, and various other nonprofit organizations were filing cases challenging birthright citizenship. That law has never taken effect. So not one single baby has been born subject to Trump's executive order, thanks to court orders. So the Trump administration has now filed a cert petition trying to get the Supreme Court to reverse the decisions in our second case, the class action, and in Washington State's challenge to the birthright citizenship order. So that case was considered, their cert petitions were considered by the Supreme Court the Friday before Thanksgiving, and they issued an order saying they're going to look at it again tomorrow, this Friday.
Oh, wow.
So we'll find out soon whether—
By the time this airs, I might not be a citizen anymore.
Your citizenship is safe.
Okay. Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
But actually, this is important.
No.
The fact that the court takes the case will not put anyone's citizenship in jeopardy.
Well, that's good to
know. It just means they will hear the case.
But just to be clear, just to put a fine pin on this, birthright citizenship is one of those things that is like one of the founding principles of this country. The way I think about it, we wouldn't have a country without birthright citizenship because there wouldn't have been enough people to have a country.
That's right, with one caveat.
I'm ready for the caveat.
One slight correction. It's part of the second founding.
Okay. All
right. Right? It's part of Reconstruction. So.
Oh, okay. This is.
Right? Because what.
Surprised we didn't cover Reconstruction that much in any of the schools that
went
to.
I mean, surprise. But you're right.
You're right that the
concept that you're a citizen of the country where you're born is a concept that the founders brought from Britain.
Yeah.
Right? That's a British concept.
Okay.
Unlike other countries in Europe where the historical practice was that the fact that you're born in the country doesn't mean you automatically have citizenship. Your citizenship flows from where your parents are citizens. Right. The English, the British tradition was that you have birthright based on where you're born. So the founders, you're right. The founders did bring that concept to the United States. But of course, at the founding of the country, mm-hmm. people who were enslaved, African-Americans, mm-hmm. did not have citizenship. And it was not until after the Civil War and when Congress is writing the Reconstruction Amendments and the 14th Amendment that they now clarify that everybody born in this country, not just white people, have citizenship. And so the big fight is, you know, Donald Trump in this cynical move says, well, the 14th Amendment, which begins with this promise of birthright citizenship, before it gets to equal protection, you know, it says everyone born in the United States is a citizen. Donald Trump's cynical argument is that only applies to African Americans, that the only point of the birthright citizenship clause was to confer citizenship on formerly enslaved people. But that's just simply wrong, because we know from the congressional record and the history of the ratification of the 14th Amendment that both the proponents and the opponents of birthright citizenship understood that it meant that everyone, regardless of race. In fact, you know, the opponents said, hey, if we ratify this birthright citizenship clause, it's going to mean that the children of Chinese people, or the opponents said, we can't ratify this because we'll have, you know, other people of color, Chinese people are going to be citizens. And that was debated. And the 14th Amendment, including the birthright citizenship, was written with
that
in mind.
So they thought about, they could have actually narrowed it if they wanted to.
And they did not.
They did not. If we were to lose that, that feels like a real, like, kicking out like a real pillar of the country, like a real, like, we're not the same anymore.
Absolutely right.
Yeah.
And that would be a real, I just don't see how the Supreme Court can be seen as a legitimate institution at that point.
Yeah. Whew. So I'm going to try to look at other cases. Are there other cases that we haven't talked about for next season of Supreme Court Live?
I would say, you know, one of the things that I think will be a bridge between last season and this season of, you know, Supreme Court, the ACLU, the Supreme Court show, is the cases where we represented a party in the Supreme Court were by and large these sort of hot button cases, the rights of trans youth to have medical care, and the redistricting case, et cetera. There were a number of kind of below the radar cases that really were significant for people's civil rights and civil liberties, where we filed amicus briefs. Mm-hmm. And they were, many of those were by sort of cross-ideological right-left coalition briefs. And the Supreme Court reached the right decision in many of those cases that were sort of below the radar, not hot button cases. And the same is true this year. We have signed on to several sort of cross-ideological briefs that will be interesting, and where I think there's a really good chance the Supreme Court is going to reach the right decision and protect people's rights, protect people's access to the courts as an avenue for protecting their freedoms. To give one example, there is a case that was just argued called First Choice Women's Center versus Platkin. Mm-hmm. This is a case kind of similar to, you know, a couple seasons ago, a couple terms ago, when we represented the National Rifle Association in its effort to defend itself against New York State financial regulators who were targeting them because of their viewpoint. So in this case, the Attorney General of New Jersey, Matt Platkin, issued this very invasive subpoena against the First Choice Women's Center, which is a nonprofit that runs a crisis pregnancy center, right? One of these anti-abortion outfits. And even though the ACLU has raised a lot of serious policy concerns about crisis pregnancy centers and the ways in which they might be misleading consumers, this was a case where we joined a cross-ideological brief to raise the First Amendment problems. So what happened was the Crisis Pregnancy Center gets a subpoena that asks for all kinds of invasive information, including their donor, not only the identities of their donors, but their communications with their donors.
Oh, wow. So like the emails and...
Right. This is, you know who brought a case like this and first established that the First Amendment prevents this? The NAACP.
Oh, yep.
Right?
That tracks.
Yeah. So during the civil rights era, federal government was trying to investigate the NAACP's donors and supporters. And the whole point of it was to chill people, to scare people off so that they wouldn't join the NAACP. Mm-hmm. And the NAACP sued and ends up winning this precedent in the Supreme Court. So this is that case. So the Crisis Pregnancy Center goes into federal court and says, hey, we got this subpoena from New Jersey and this violates our First Amendment rights. And the federal district court said, you don't have a ripe claim. Come back later because you haven't, the state hasn't done anything to you. They haven't, you know, held you in contempt for failing to comply with the subpoena and turn over your donor records. And so we signed on to a brief in support of the Crisis Pregnancy Center saying, you know, this violates the First Amendment. And they do have a ripe claim because the mere fact that the attorney general of the state has, you know, sent the subpoena is probably enough to create a chill for people who want to donate money to this nonprofit. So that's one of the cases where, you know, like last term, we're signing on to a cross ideological brief. Just to give one more example, there's a case that's already been argued called Landor versus Louisiana Department of Corrections. It's a case with horrible facts. Mr. Landor is Black. He is Rastafarian, and he was incarcerated in a Louisiana state prison. And he wears his hair in dreadlocks, as his faith requires. And the prison officials told him they were that he had to cut his hair because of the prison's general grooming standards. And he prints out a copy of a decision by the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit, which I keep mentioning today. and it says that people have a religious, you know, if you have a religious reason, you have a First Amendment right and a right under this federal statute to have an accommodation. And the prison officials literally throw his printout of this legal ruling from the federal court into the trash.
Wow.
They hold him down and forcibly shave his head.
Yeah.
And then he's released.
Yeah.
So the question is, can Mr. Landor file a damages case in order to vindicate his religious freedom rights?
I'm going
to
rule on that. Yes, he can. That's my ruling.
I think the court is going to reach the right decision.
Yeah.
We signed on to a brief led by the Christian Legal Society and, you know, mostly, you know, sort of a conservative coded, self-identified right wing religious freedom groups in support of Mr. Landor. So I think there are a number of cases that raise you know, important civil rights and civil liberties issues where everyone can agree from right to left that that the court should protect people's rights.
I mean, you know, I want to ask you if there are any other wins that we need to talk about from the year. But I think many of us had given up on left-right coalition building, you know, in sort of in the broad terms, you know, in the ways, especially at the high levels. You know, I think we all know, I think maybe generally we all sort of know in our lives, that guy votes differently than I do, but we also work together, you know, whatever. We may not see it that way. We may be able to build those coalitions, but I don't think we thought of, like, at the high levels that there was a lot of left-right coalition building happening.
There is a ton of left-right coalition building happening when it comes to nonprofit organizations who are litigating cases or filing briefs in the federal courts of this country. So I would say, you know, now more than ever, we need to make coalitions with people who have a shared goal.
Yeah.
And I'd point to the case where we represented the NRA as a key example of that, right? You know, 2 years ago when we said we were going to represent the NRA in a First Amendment case in the Supreme Court, you know, we had a lot of internal, you know, disagreement about that. And there were our colleagues in the ACLU and members of the ACLU who didn't like the fact that we were representing the NRA. And, you know, I remember saying at the time, first of all, the ACLU stands on principle.
Yes.
And when it comes to freedom of speech, religious freedom, et cetera, you know, we have to stand up for principle. But, you know, I also said at the time to people who, you know, were expressing concerns, I said, Donald Trump may be president again next year. And, you know, it's really important that we stand up for the right of the NRA against the right financial regulators in New York State. Because if the NRA loses this case, then Donald Trump or Ron DeSantis or Greg Abbott or anyone government officials who don't like what the ACLU does or what Planned Parenthood does or fill in your favorite organization can do the same thing.
Yeah.
And lo and behold, it's actually true that this year, as we've brought, you know, 118 lawsuits in, you know, these First Amendment cases, we are citing the Supreme Court's decision in NRA versus Vullo that we won in order to prevent government officials, state and federal, from violating people's First Amendment rights. So, you know, we don't bring those First Amendment claims and cases in order to benefit ourselves alone. We do them because we believe in the principle. Mm-hmm. But it goes to show that, you know, one reason it's important to do that is because, you know, we can't let government officials decide what we say, what we advocate for, and, you know, what we believe.
Amen. Am I allowed to say amen on the ACLU podcast?
Absolutely.
Freedom of speech. Freedom of speech. So are there any other wins that you want to talk about from this year? I think lost court cases, lawsuits we can celebrate. I see something about defending our neighbors fund.
Yes. So there are a lot of litigation victories, but I'll talk about the Defending Our Neighbors Fund first. So the ACLU joined with United We Dream and the Abundant Futures Fund to start this effort to make sure that people who are caught up in the Trump administration's immigration mm-hmm. dragnet mm-hmm. are able to defend themselves. So many non-citizens in this country are being arrested. People who may have a legal right to be here, because let's be clear, he's going after legal people who are lawfully in the country,
yeah.
as well as people whose visas have expired or who came in without authorization. And, you know, you don't have a right to appointed counsel if you get caught up in the deportation system, unlike if you get caught up with a criminal charge mm-hmm. where the government is obligated to, provide you with a lawyer. You don't have that immigration. And so we knew that the president was going to be casting this dragnet across American communities, going after immigrants and putting them in detention and trying to deport them. So we helped to start this fund that is meant to provide lawyers for people who can't afford lawyers, with a goal of raising $30 million for people. And so far, we've gotten a third of the way there. So thanks to all of our members who've supported that work.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
And I just like the title, the name, Defending Our Neighbors Fund. That just seems like who doesn't want to donate to that fund? Because you have a neighbor or you are somebody's neighbor.
That's right.
Yeah. More coalition building.
Yep.
Any other wins or lawsuits or cases that your favorites?
Well, like I said, we've brought 118 actions against the Trump administration Ooh. Since January 20th.
And even that's a win. Just
that
level of busyness.
You're
and
attention. Right. Yeah. You're right. Yeah. Because, you know, resisting, you bring lawsuits, of course, to win and to get concrete relief for people yeah. whose rights are being taken away.
Yeah.
But you also bring lawsuits in order to show the world what is happening here. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so you're right, it is a win. But, you know, we've got about an 80% to 85% success rate, like I said, in those cases. So there are a lot of wins to talk about. Birthright citizenship, of course, is one we've already talked about.
Yeah.
There are a number of immigration policies where we have scored wins, where the mm-hmm. Trump administration has basically shut down asylum in mm-hmm. this country. Mm-hmm. And there, again, we've blocked or delayed the implementation of those federal policies. There is a whole spate of wins in cases where we are challenging the Trump administration's threats or efforts to defund, to take away federal funding based on people engaging in disfavored advocacy.
Mm-hmm.
So we've stopped or blocked the National Endowment of the Arts from defunding arts organizations that engage in what Trump calls gender ideology or other DEI-related activities. We've blocked book bans in K-12 schools that are operated by the Department of Defense. I guess he calls it the Department of War now.
Yeah.
You know, there were hundreds of books that were banned by the Trump administration from, you know, public school libraries operated on military bases in the United States and around the world. We stopped the government from taking down scientific and medical research from a government-run website called PSNet for not only things that government would tag as a DEI, for example, research into racial disparities in medical outcomes, but also, you know, on the list of disfavored terms for those takedowns was COVID vaccine hesitancy. right? We've scored wins against the Department of Education's so-called Dear Colleague letter, where the Department of Ed was threatening to defund educational institutions around the country that engaged in efforts relating to DEI, gender ideology, et cetera. They're disfavored topics that the president doesn't like. We have challenged various immigration policies, including the use of abominable conditions, inhuman conditions at ICE detention centers, the deliberate cruelty. Mm-hmm. We've challenged in, you know, ACLU state affiliates have brought so many, you know, habeas corpus petitions challenging the ways in which Trump is blowing past all norms and laws in detaining people who show up for their immigration court proceedings as, again, an act of cruelty, as a show of force. So I could go on and on.
Yeah.
One important one that I do want to call out is in Los Angeles, in addition to the racial profiling case Vasquez-Perdomo that I mentioned already, where the Supreme Court issued this terrible order, we brought another case where we've won so far and prevailed, challenging what the government, federal government, was doing in LA when they used these really excessive, violent measures to go after protesters, journalists who are covering protests, and legal monitors, people who were observing protests and crowd control response, in a case that was where our lead plaintiff is the LA Press Club. So there are so many cases where we have stopped or delayed Trump administration actions in federal courts. And I'm just so proud of the work that my colleagues are doing around the country.
I'm proud of you.
Thank you, Kamau.
Am I allowed to be proud of you?
You are, of course.
Really, it really does make me feel very happy to know that you're out there doing this work, and you do it with such a warm spirit, but also fierce, determined sense. I can feel that in your core, and you corrected me very gently, which I also appreciate. You didn't have to do it. You corrected me very, and I appreciate that. So I actually do appreciate that. So my last hard-hitting question is, what are you going to do in the interim between seasons of Great British Bake Off? What are you going to watch? What are you going to do?
You know, I think I'll watch some reruns of your show.
That does the same exact comfort food, casual viewing, United States of America. Yeah. If only we could get those people, I'd be back on the air. I could get the same numbers as that show. Yeah.
You know, I think on a serious note, I think it is really important that those of us who are doing this work and all the ways we're doing it, you as well as me, that we find ways to, you know, enjoy the arts, to enjoy comedy, to enjoy, you know, the things that sustain us through these hard times. So
thank you for this. Now, the ACLU's got your back heading into the new year, but this podcast feed is going to look and, well, sound a little different in 2026. For one, this is my last episode as the host of At Liberty, and there are actually some major changes coming to this podcast feed. Don't go anywhere. Stay subscribed. Stay tuned. Things are coming.
Wait, hang on.
We're done.
I'm turning the tables on you.
No, my thing says we're done.
No, we have a lightning round where I'm turning the tables on you.
Okay. All right.
So you always end. This is your last episode.
Yes.
As the host of the At Liberty podcast.
Yeah.
Brought to you by the ACLU.
Yes.
And so
I closed it. I shut it down.
It was a mic. It's a mic drop.
Yeah.
Here's your mic drop moment.
Okay.
So you've closed, I think, every episode by asking guests three questions. Mm-hmm. I'm going to ask them to you.
Oh, it's like inside the actor studio.
Yeah.
All right.
So the first question is, what do you want our listeners to do?
So no matter what form and function this podcast takes, and I feel the same way about me, continue to be involved with the ACLU, continue to be connected to your local community organizations that the ACLU does a great job of connecting people to. Stay in the fight. Like, this is not a, you know, the season of this podcast may end but the fight continues. So continue to stay involved with the ACLU.
What do you want our listeners to know?
We who believe in freedom cannot rest.
Can you sing it?
Yes, even though not well, but I'll say, we who believe in freedom cannot rest.
Thank you.
There you go.
And finally, I think the most important question,
Yeah.
What gives you hope?
Huh. It's one of those questions where if I think too much about it, I'll start to fall apart. So I got three kids.
Mm-hmm.
And 14, 11, 7 for now. They get older. So sort of looking them in the eye at the beginning of the day and the end of the day and tracking what they're doing and also explaining to them what I'm doing and going to one of them recently going like, I think we have to stop using this music streaming platform because I think they do bad things. And having that kid go, can I keep it as long as I don't go to that coffee shop that does bad things? I was just like, what a great kid this, you know, that she's saying, I'm going to miss that, but I promise I will also support in this way. And I thought, I don't think I was that sophisticated at 14 mm-hmm. to be able to sort of negotiate my boycotts. So like, yeah. So knowing that my kids seem to have some understanding of what I do in the world and also have an understanding of what it is to be a good person in the world. Yeah.
Yeah. That gives me hope too.
Yeah.
Before we let you go, Kamau, we actually have a couple of listener questions and messages for you.
Uh-oh.
Hi, Kamau. It's Padma. I'm so glad I got to be on the podcast when you were interviewing me. Mm-hmm. You're such a great interviewer, as we all know. But as you reflect on your work with the ACLU's podcast, I was wondering, what is the hardest thing about doing a podcast for the ACLU? And also, what was your hardest interview and why?
So funny. It's so funny to think like I just talked to Padma at the City Arts and Lectures about her new cookbook. Mm-hmm. And there's a moment on stage I had that was like, I used to be on my wife, then girlfriend's couch watching this lady on TV. And now we're sort of like bantering back and forth. So there's always this moment about being outside myself whenever like Padma's like, come out. I'm like, the TV's talking.
She probably feels the same way about you.
No, she doesn't. She knows who she is. Talk about a person who uses their privilege in ways that they could get away with not doing. I mm-hmm. think, you know, as we talked about. So did I answer her question? I think I answered. What is the hardest thing about doing an ACLU podcast? I mean, I just always want to be clear. Like just recently, like we were talking, you went 18, 27, 92, to not pretend like I know what that is. Not pretend, oh yeah, 18, 22, 97. Like to actually be open to being like, I don't know what that is. Or be clear, like,
it's not your job to know what that is.
But you know how interviewers can get. They can get like, oh yeah. And I would hate for somebody to watch this and think that I was pretending, or to they not understand what it is because I didn't feel comfortable saying, I don't know what that is. Like, so I think that's the thing that makes it reminding myself it's okay to be like, I don't know what this person's talking, which in life it's fine, but you know how you lawyers get. You just go so high level sometimes.
That is so interesting because I feel like this is the third time I've been a guest on your podcast and, you know, I come, you know, nervous. What are you going to ask me? You know, am I going to stumble on something?
Yeah, you're always worried about like, can we re-record? I don't know if we've ever had to. Yeah. No, I don't.
But if you don't know, then the listener is not going to know.
That's literally the thrust of my entire career. Like you just described my entire public career as a person on TV and in podcasting. Like my whole thing is like, if I don't know, somebody else doesn't know.
That's right.
But I think sometimes with this, like I could sort of, because I think I'm here for the ACLU, I could just be like, uh-huh, sure. Yeah, that makes sense. And not know what's, so I have to make sure that so that's the most challenging thing about, the hardest interview, none of them have been, they're all their own different challenges. I think sometimes I just wish we were all in the room together, you know, mm-hmm. like this is great.
This is really great.
So that's the only thing but there's nobody, I'm trying to think, is there ever an interview in the ACLU where I was like, no, because even when there's, no, I mean, yeah, this is a different, like if it's my thing, there's different things that, but you know, this is, but my hardest interview in life, I don't know if she's asking that question, but anyway.
Hey, Kamau, it's Ben Weisner. Congrats on an amazing run. Thanks for all you've done to spread the gospel with wit and joy. Best wishes for a great holiday and happy new year.
Kamau, it was great to be in conversation with you. Thank you for providing the space to talk about the important civil rights and civil liberties issues of the day and for making it fun and funny.
Hi, my name is Maribel Hernandez Rivera. Thank you, Kamau, for all your work to keep our listeners informed. And also, thanks to all our listeners for being with us as we do all that we can to protect our civil rights and civil liberties. 2025 has been challenging, but we are resolute in our commitment to protect our democracy and to protect our communities.
Yay. Maribel always understands the assignment.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'm going to take a little privilege for a second.
Okay. All right.
I'm Jess Weitz. I am the National Director of Artists and Entertainment Engagement for the ACLU.
I know who you are. You don't have to tell me.
I'm telling all your listeners.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
What you have done over this past year has just opened up this work that we do in a way that, to your point, you are our voice, you are our eyes, and you're also the one who holds us accountable sometimes. But it has been the utmost privilege to work with you in this way. Because I'm going to make you cry, my friend.
Why are we doing this?
So we have a few things that we did for you.
Was I diagnosed with something that nobody told me about?
We didn't tell you. Melissa didn't want to be the one to break it to you. I drew the short straw.
Did you get the results from my physician? What's happening? Like, what is happening? What? This way? I was like, why is Jess flying out here? Just because, what is happening?
We love you, Kamau.
Thanks.
This is on behalf of Sam and Erica and Mariah and me and everyone
at
the
ACLU. You know, I'm not retiring, right? I still have to like work.
Oh God, you are most definitely not retired. Let me actually put this in the record.
Yeah.
You continue on as our racial justice ambassador. You continue on doing the work.
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And I continue to call on you on a fairly regular basis. But you did something really important this year.
I didn't do anything.
You were busy and you did this too.
That's because you asked me to.
And so we regret this. Well, I don't ask you to do.
I know. That's why I did it, because you asked me.
Unimportant things.
I was like, you're like, we're looking for a host. I was like, what about me? And you said, okay. And I said, okay, then I'll do it. Like, I don't understand. What is.
As I texted you under a table during a meeting.
Yeah, I don't understand why we're acting like this is a big deal.
It is. It was a big deal for me. It was a big deal for us. And just say thank you.
What? I'm happy for everyone I've met. I'm happy to have new people that are like this. I'm happy to know that like I can send up the bat signal if I have problems, and that these people think I'm worth a damn. You know, that's great. But what is happening?
Shall we have some cake?
I guess so. Thanks again to our guest Cecilia Wong, and to you for listening. And remember, friends, friends help friends stay in the fight. Join us! Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed this episode of At Liberty, please subscribe on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. If you haven't already, rate the show and leave us a review. And you can also tell us what's giving you hope right now. At Liberty is a production of the ACLU in conjunction with Who Knows Best Productions, which is Melissa Hudson Bell, PhD, and me. For the ACLU, our senior executive producer is Sam Riddell. Our executive producer is Jessica Herman-Weitz, and our intern is Maud V. Kianra. At Liberty is produced and edited by Erica Ghetto and Mariah Gossett for Good Get. And this episode was recorded at the Great Skyline Studios in Oakland, California. Brian! Until next time, I'm your host, W. Kamau Bell.